is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me,
the genes of you and me,
we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.
You're listening to DNA Today, a genetics podcast and radio show. I'm your host, Kira Dineen. DNA Today informs you on what's happening in the genetic world. During my broadcast, I educate the public on genetics and other health topics through event coverage, news stories, book reviews, and interviews. Guests include genetic counselors, researchers, patient advocates, and professors in the field of genetics. Today on my show is Dr. Susan Capasso. She is the Vice President of Academic Affairs, Dean of Faculty, and the Chief Academic Officer of St. Vincent's College. She received her BA at the University of Vermont, MS from Georgetown University, and EDD from the University of Hartford. Dr. Capasso is a licensed and certified genetic counselor and serves as a genetic counselor at St. Vincent's Medical Center. Thanks for joining me. So let's start with just kind of a basic overview for those that don't know of what genetic counseling is and what roles genetic counseling serve in the healthcare community.
Well, genetic counselors help the patients to understand their probability of getting a disease. We do family histories. We do genetic testing. We do education in the community about genetics with physicians and other healthcare workers. Some genetic counselors do research. Some are in private practice with physicians. Others are in medical centers. Others are in research centers.
And there's a lot of different pathways to becoming a genetic counselor. Some become genetic counselors and go to grad school straight out of college. Some kind of end up doing a mid-career change. What has been your journey of becoming a genetic counselor and, you know, once you became one, kind of the different directions you've taken in your career?
Okay. I went to University of Vermont and I got my degree in zoology, and then I went to Georgetown University and got my master's in biology and genetics, and then I went to work at St. Christopher's Hospital for Children in Philadelphia as a genetic counselor and cytotechnologist. And it worked really well for me. It was like the very beginning when we were first starting to get genetic counselors. At that point in time, Sarah Lawrence was the only school, along with Rutgers, that were giving out the degrees. So, and I was a little different from that because since I didn't go to a genetic counseling program. Then I, after I left there, I went to Connecticut because my husband had graduated from optometry school and we were coming back to Connecticut from Philadelphia. And it was about a year later that I took the first certification exam. I took it at Yale. And it was the first year that everybody had to go in and take the test. And then during that time period, on the 80s and into the 90s, I was teaching at Wilcox College. I was teaching nursing students, and I taught them genetics, but I also taught them anatomy and physiology and some of the other sciences. And I did some genetic counseling at my husband's practice and other optometric practices for ocular diseases. Then I went to St. Vincent's College in 1998. I have been there since. I have done different roles. My latest ones have been as the dean and then as the vice president. I have taught there the sciences also and genetics, served on a committee in the state of Connecticut with for the expert in genomic and genetics advisory committee, and I've done some grants for education in genetics, and I set up 5 years ago a high-risk clinic at St. Vincent's Cancer Center for cancer patients so that we could begin to do genetic testing on them.
So at this clinic, what types of genetic testing are you doing and were starting to do at that time?
In the beginning, we were doing single-site testing, and primarily we were doing tests for breast cancer, breast and ovarian cancer disease, and also for Lynch syndrome.
And how does the test now differ today from when kind of the field started and when people started identifying these different genes? How far have we come in terms of testing?
Well, today we have we can now test multiple genes. We don't have to just do the sequential testing and test one or two genes. And also we're finding that some of the patients that had breast cancer who were shown to be BRCA1 or BRCA2 negative have other genes that cause their cancer.
It goes beyond BRCA.
It goes beyond that. And some of those people, in fact, last week I had three patients come in. All three of them were being tested with the panel test because they were BRCA1 and BRCA2 negative, but they still wanted, their physicians are sending them in now to find out if they have another gene, because if they do have another gene, that could affect other organ systems in their body. And we want to, because they'll have increased risk of cancer in those too, so we want to be able to identify this. Also, if they have the gene, it would be a 50% chance, since it's an autosomal dominant, that they would pass this on to their children. And they want to know that.
And so the risk for most hereditary cancers, now that only accounts for 5 to 10% of cancers. Most
yes.
are sporadic.
Yes.
But for those that are hereditary cancers, things such as breast cancer, ovarian cancer, can also be linked to prostate cancer. So
yes.
it's not just women that need to be concerned.
Right. And that is a concern, because there are still physicians that are out there that think that you can only have BRCA 1 and 2 if you worry about it if you are a female. There's even one insurance company, I won't say the name, but there's one insurance company that gives me a hard time and gives other genetic counselors a hard time if they want to test men for BRCA 2.
Which it's not only their risk that we need to be concerned about. They can also have male breast cancer, prostate cancers associated, but for their children.
And pancreatic.
Pancreatic
yes.
as well. But
yeah.
yeah, for their siblings. So it goes beyond just the proband or the person being
and
tested.
And their own children too at a later time.
Definitely. And so genetic counselors, really, it's hard for them to take on this big role of taking family history. So how can we get other healthcare practitioners to begin, taking that family history and seeing how important it is and actually being able to kind of identify that something may be hereditary cancer and then refer to a genetic counselor? How can we start that process?
In the past 8 years, I've been working with the Department of Public Health here in Connecticut on a whole plan to get all nurses to understand the importance of taking good family history and be able to pick up whether or not somebody has some type of genetic disorder. And there are some competencies in nursing right now that you're supposed to follow, but not all schools in the state of Connecticut and in other states are actually teaching genetics to their nursing students. And
that's
this
a major
is
area to leave out of
it
education.
It is. And it's very important that nurses understand genetics. And so that's been my goal for the past 8 years. My students and the students at St. V's are all taught genetics. And in fact, it's a thread in our curriculum for our radiography and also for our nursing, that they understand genetics and they can do a 3-generation pedigree. So this is something that needs to be continued of nurses. I also talked at a conference for anatomy and physiology with the Human Anatomy and Physiology Society and discussed with them that you've really got to put more genetics into anatomy and physiology, which is a course that's really only taken by nurses and allied health students. And so I did a presentation on that, and I did a paper on it, where it's showing where you need to put it in. It should be threaded through the entire curriculum, just like you thread lifespan issues, and so that everybody understands and this is ingrained in them when they become a nurse or another healthcare worker.
So when taking a family history, what are the important aspects to be looking at? What are some of the red flags that may stand up for, it could be hereditary cancer or another type of condition that could be running in a family? What should healthcare practitioners really be zoning in on?
Well, you want to look at the patterns of inheritance. You want to look at that. You want to see if there's any consanguinity. And sometimes people won't talk about that, but in others, they will talk about it. You want to see what was the age of the diagnosis of a specific disease, and that's especially important in cancer.
Age of onset. Very key.
Age of onset. If I'm 90 years old, that's much different than being a 35-year-old who had breast cancer. You want to look at that. You want to look at their ethnicity. You want to look at if somebody is a, if you're a male and you got breast cancer as opposed to a female who had breast cancer. So you want to look at what is the sex of the person who has the specific disease. You want to look at family, as much as they know about their family members, and go back three generations.
At least.
At least.
If you can.
And threes,
yes,
sometimes can be tough.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And some of the different types of conditions can be sporadic, as we kind of mentioned mm-hmm. before. That means it's not inherited. It's mm-hmm. from environmental factors. But there's also familia and hereditary, as we mm-hmm. talked about. Now, people hear familia, hereditary, sometimes people use them interchangeably.
Right.
What is the difference?
Familial means that you have the environment working with the genes. So you could have three people that don't have one specific gene, but there might be just their genes working together with the environment. Maybe it was where they lived, what they did for a living. You look at all those types of factors.
Now, just being in the field as long as you have, what are some really big changes and kind of things that have really evolved over time, for lack of a better word, that you've seen in genetic counseling and in cytogenetics and all of these related fields? What are some of these big changes that you've kind of really seen?
Well, back in the 70s, I worked in a cystic fibrosis clinic, and we didn't have a way to do prenatal testing for it. That was big, because I remember seeing so many children dying from cystic fibrosis. Some of the tests, the prenatal testing now, it's gone so far. I was in the field when it was only a few years before we started doing amniocentesis. So the new prenatal diagnostic techniques, the testing for the cancer, all of the things that all the molecular tests that are now done with the DNA. It's fascinating what can be done.
And how do you see the public's perception and education level of genetics? Do you see that people are really learning more, or because there's so much more information, it's harder for people to keep up with and they kind of end up getting lost?
I see more people today look at genetics and understand genetics a little bit better than they did before. In the old days, it was kind of like you hear the word genetics and you think it's hard and you don't want any part of it.
And It's hard.
It is hard, but you know, when you have a good teacher, you can learn concepts that are hard. And I think that that's what many of my students have found, that some things that may have been hard, they now understand. Like probability. They hear probability, they go, oh, I hate math. But then when you sit down and you look at it, okay, what is the probability in an autosomal recessive disease that if you have the disease that your sister's also a carrier? So, you know, it's things like that.
And really being able to be a science communicator has been such a big skill in this field.
I believe that it is, yes. And patience.
Patience. Because when you're communicating something, sometimes it takes a little bit.
Sometimes it takes five or six times. And you also know that you're also dealing with guilt. And you're also dealing with people that don't want to know something. And they're scared. Many of the people that I deal with are very scared. As in a case of what I pointed out today about the patient that I had who had a PALB2 mutation and had breast cancer, her father was devastated because he knew the gene came from him. And just to see his face, because he was there, you know, we had to stop and we had to just go back and had to say, you know, this is not your fault.
You didn't decide, genes. I'm going to give her this chromosome with the mutated gene.
And we all carry mutated genes.
Yes. None of us don't have mutations, and sometimes mutations can be good, but the ones we're talking about are negative.
So as a genetic counselor, I spend a lot of my time as a psychologist and someone who listens and people cry. People come in and get their result and they laugh and cry. They cry even from being happy and give me a hug and tell me, it's like, well, I didn't do this, but, you know, this is your result. So it's a very rewarding profession.
And those tough cases are often the ones that are rewarding because you put time into it and you are spending time with those patients and looking at what they have, but you also are sometimes putting more effort into it and really having to look deeper into data.
But I also felt very bad about, as the patient that I was mentioning again, because if we had done a panel test and found a year and a half ago that she had two genes. She had one gene that we didn't weren't even looking for, and she didn't have the gene we were looking for. We might have been able to help her because she has stage 3 cancer right now, and she's only 32 years old. So
that's one of the reasons that these gene panels are mm-hmm. really being utilized today, mm-hmm. because you can test for really an array of different
yes.
genes, and depending on what condition a patient is suspected to have, if it's Lynch syndrome, you can have a Lynch mm-hmm. syndrome panel.
Right.
Now, one thing that I'd love to talk about is getting kids excited about science. I was one of those kids that was always excited about science and wanted to learn more, but it's kind of seems to be almost dwindling, that maybe teachers aren't as excited about science, or that teaching it is kind of hard. You started the summer outreach program at St. Vincent's, mm-hmm. and so kind of give us a sense of how you get kids excited about science and what people can do inside the classroom, but also outside the classroom, to get kids interested and just introduced.
Well, when I first did the camp, it was about 8-10 years ago, and I did it for 6 summers. I got funding from the state of Connecticut, and I got funding from some other organizations. But what I wanted to do was to show minorities, because I work in Bridgeport, minorities as well as minorities and men also, to go into the field of nursing and to go into more healthcare positions. And I wanted to show them how much fun that science can be. So what I did was I made my camp basically a CSI forensic camp.
I mean, how much cooler can you get?
And then every day we go in. And for example, I wanted to teach them also about microbiology, because I've been teaching microbiology. So what I did was we set up a whole area one day that was Africa. And we all went to Africa and we saw the dead bodies from the Ebola. And then we had a crime scene with the Ebola. So I not only had the Ebola for the micro, but I also had, we learned about that. We learned about the who came in there and killed one of the people that were there, and they didn't die of Ebola. They was something else. We set that up. We also learned about cultural differences, social differences, and I incorporated all that in there. And we actually learned some African words. So we had a lot of fun doing that. I did it with my students, and many of the faculty worked with me. And then we would come in every day. We went to Haiti. We went to where we had cholera. We went and did this through the week. And I would have a different theme every year for my camp, but it was all basically doing CSI. And I have to say, when you get somebody interested, you can teach them how to blood type very quickly with simulated blood when they're interested in doing it, because my eighth graders were going faster than some of my nursing students. So I think, and again, it's patience and it's making something interesting. And I think that a lot of the stuff that kids are getting in school may not interest them.
And it's not as hands-on. Labs in high schools and middle schools, I didn't have that many, and I'm from Connecticut, and I think seeing more of that hands-on doing things and being so mm-hmm. immersed, you created really a culture of being excited and mm-hmm. immersing them to different cultures.
Yes.
So it's definitely a cool aspect of it.
So the camp was a lot of fun. It was unfortunate that the state of Connecticut ran out of money to give to me, and the other group didn't really have enough money left to be able to give us enough, and the school wasn't going to do that. So what I do now instead is we have a partnership with Reed School in Bridgeport, and their eighth graders come in for maybe once a week for 4 weeks, and I do different things with them.
Kind of mini lessons.
Little
events.
Mini lessons.
Yeah.
And I'm shocked that in 2016 that eighth graders haven't used microscopes before.
That is shocking. It's sad, too.
It is very sad, because they're so excited, and they're like, oh, I've never used this. I've seen the pictures of them. And we sit there, and they learn how to do it, and we look at pond water, and we learn about different types of diseases that you can get from things that are in the pond. Mm-hmm. And we always do our blood typing and learn about, we start to do some genetics. And they don't want to leave, I have to say. They
yeah.
don't want to leave.
And just introducing that even earlier, you're talking about eighth graders, which is still early on relatively, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I've read something, and I can't cite where I read it from, but that, you know, by like fourth grade, kids kind of decide whether they like the STEM fields or not,
mm-hmm.
which is so sad to me, because by then I hadn't really decided what I was wanting to do. But really getting kids excited from that young age is so crucial.
Yes, it is.
Now, talking about kind of the other side of students that are maybe in college or in grad school, what advice do you have for kids that are interested in genetic counseling and want to be applying to these schools, and they really want to set up their application to be the best they can? What advice do you have for them to really make that happen?
Well, I think you need to have a background in science, but you also should have some of the social sciences, and you have to have your math. And I think all those go into becoming, and to want to work with people. You're also going to need patience. That's not in your application. But you're going to need a lot of patience when you're working with patients. And you're also going to see that, you're going to be working with people who may not understand science at all, who may not be speaking the same language as you. And I have a lot of that in Bridgeport. I have a lot of people that are from Portuguese background or Spanish background. You need to be able to, it's really something that you really good, it's a gratifying profession, and you need to be kind of a special person.
And really be able to
connect with people. You got to counsel them. And I can only tell you that it's extremely rewarding and it really pays off, but you still got to have that science background. And I would say even more so today with all the tests that are out there.
Yes, it's a lot to keep up on.
Yes,
and you do have to keep up on it
And we're moving at a fast pace.
You can't read everything, but as much as you really can, definitely. No. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show and just sharing your expertise. If you want to find a genetic counselor in your area, please go to nsgc.org. There you can use the feature Find a Genetic Counselor. You can find someone in your area. If there's no one close enough, there are genetic counselors that do phone calls where you can set up an appointment via phone. But that about wraps up today's episode. Thanks so much for sharing again your expertise. You can go to dnapodcast.com and also on Twitter at dnapodcast. Any questions for the two of us at info@dnapodcast.com. Thanks for listening and join me next week to learn and discover new advances in the world of genetics.
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.